WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This Saturday night, Bob Wilbur will lead a Carnegie Hall concert in tribute to the late clarinetist Benny Goodman. It's a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Goodman's precedent-setting 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot described Bob Wilbur as a superb soprano saxophonist, a classic clarinetist, a gifted arranger and composer, and an invaluable preserver and enhancer of jazz tradition. Bob Wilbur came of age in the 1940s, but unlike most of the jazz musicians of his generation, he wasn't interested in the modern idiom bebop. Wilbur's mentor was the New Orleans musician Sidney Bechet. Wilbur studied with him, played with him, even moved in with him. Today, Wilbur's repertoire includes music by many of the composers who created the language of jazz, such as Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, and James P. Johnson. Wilbur co-founded the New York Jazz Repertory Company and led the Smithsonian Jazz Repertory Ensemble. Wilbur arranged and conducted the music recreations for the movie Cotton Club, which was set in Harlem in the 1930s. His autobiography, Music Was Not Enough, will be published in the United States next month. He joins us today from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we listen to some of his records, this is an excerpt of Don't Be That Way from Benny Goodman's 1938 Carnegie Hall concert, a song Wilbur will perform this Saturday at the Tribute. Bob Wilbur, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
You're doing a tribute to the Benny Goodman 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. What makes that concert so important in jazz history?
A lot of things. It was the first time that jazz was presented at Carnegie Hall, which probably the first time that jazz was really presented in the right way in a concert hall in the United States. I think that was important, and it was a time when the popular culture, a figure who in his day was maybe the equivalent of, say, a Michael Jackson or a Prince, was presented to the cultural elite of New York and was a big hit. He went from there to the Paramount Theater the next week, where he was playing for the teenagers and the kids. It was a great event because it showed black and white musicians working together on the same stage, which in 1938 was still a rarity.
Now, what approach are you taking in your concert on Saturday? Are you playing transcriptions, or are you copying the solos that were done in the 1938 concert?
We're using all the same arrangements that Benny Goodman used, and we've acquired them from the Lincoln Center Library and from the Yale University Library, where Benny left them. And we are going to be very careful to recreate all the arrangements. The solos will be left to the discretion of the players, but they are all know the tradition, so the solos will be totally in keeping with the style.
I want our listeners to hear some of your playing.
Okay.
So I'm going to play a recent recording that you made with the late pianist Dick Wellstood.
Yes, he was a dear friend of mine, and it was a great loss to jazz when he died very unexpectedly last summer. One of the great exponents of stride piano.
Well, we'll show off your soprano playing a little bit later, but this is a taste of your clarinet playing. This is my guest, Bob Wilbur, along with Dick Wellstood at the piano playing You, You, You. really beautiful playing. Do you think of your tone as being influenced by Benny Goodman at all?
Well, he was my first role model, my first idol when I was a kid, just starting to play clarinet at the age of 13. And yeah, he's definitely an influence on me. Benny made the clarinet sing, and it's a very difficult instrument to sing on. It tends to be very cold and detached. And Benny made it a voice. So when you listen to his music, you're not hearing the clarinet, you're hearing Benny Goodman.
Now, you played in Goodman's band briefly. This was when? Was it in the 1950s?
Yeah, late 50s. I played tenor saxophone in the band.
Now, he had a reputation of being a very cold band leader and of giving his musicians the ray, this really evil look from his eye, if they did something that he didn't like. In your forthcoming autobiography, Music Was Not Enough, you've written that you were somebody who could say to Goodman that his reed sounded bad without getting your head chopped off. Now, what made you able to say something like that to him?
Well, I think Benny respected me as a fellow clarinetist, although I must say when I was with his band, I played a precious little clarinet. But he respected my judgment, and he'd call me into the dressing room before a concert, and he'd say, "Well, how does this sound?" And I'd say, "Geez, that doesn't sound very good, Benny. That's not a very good reed." And he would listen to me. And then years afterwards, we used to get together at his apartment and play clarinet duets and compare notes and ideas about how to play this and how to play that. So we never had any kind of run-in. But Benny was a difficult leader. He was a perfectionist, and he demanded the highest standards of himself and expected everybody else to live up to those standards.
You've also said that when you were playing in his band, he tried to add some more modern tunes to the repertoire, but that the audience has really resisted that. Was that very disappointing?
It was disappointing to him, I think, because he'd gotten tired of playing all the same old things over and over again. As you know, around 1940, he added some brilliant new arrangers to his staff, like Eddie Sauter and Mel Powell, and he was constantly looking for new ideas and new material. But the public, they really wanted to hear Sing, 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 Don't Be That Way, Down South Can't Mean, the old stuff. They never grew tired of that. And I know those people at Carnegie Hall are going to be delighted to hear exactly what was played in 1938. I remember one tour we did when we opened up in Rutland, Vermont, and it's the first time that Benny had been up there since 1939. And we just finished rehearsing some brilliant new arrangements by people like Bill Holman and Gil Evans and other fine arrangers. And we played the whole first half with these numbers. The audience sat on their hands. They were stunned because this is not what they came to hear. Benny stormed off the stage, and when he didn't hear that applause, he was very mad. He says, "It's these damn modern arrangements. They're killing the music business. Take them all out of the book." He didn't like them because the audience didn't respond. We opened up the second half with "Don't Be That Way," and the audience tore their house down.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you've led several repertory bands. When you're leading a repertory band, what do you want to bring to the music? I know you don't want to do a note-for-note transcription the way it was once recorded on record. What kind of life do you want to give to the music?
Well, you know, repertory playing is kind of a new idea in jazz. But it's something that we've had, in classical music for hundreds of years. We play Mozart today, which is music written how many years ago? 300 years. We don't think of it as being old-fashioned. It's perfectly valid today. And I feel that all the different earlier styles of jazz are still just as valid, exciting, and good music today as they were when they were invented. And I believe you can be authentic to the original style, but bring something of yourself as a performer to the music, which is, in essence, what happens when classical performers play older music. They bring part of themselves to it. Of course, in jazz, improvisation is always an important part, and there's where the musicians bring their own personality to the music, whether it's Duke Ellington or Jelly Roll Morton or Benny Goodman or whatever.
What do you say to the people who would say, "Oh, but this stuff is already recorded on albums"? I mean, we don't need people to recreate it. We don't need to, you know, hear new versions of it.
I'll tell you, I don't care how good the fidelity is on records, there's nothing like an in-person live performance. And the exciting thing about in-person performances, particularly jazz, because of the improvisation, there's always the the feeling that you may be hearing something that was never done before. You know, an improviser will suddenly get a spark and take off. This is part of the excitement of listening to jazz. It's like that famous night at Newport when Paul Gonzalez took off on crescendo and diminuendo and blue and played 26 choruses. It's like the famous moment at Carnegie Hall at the end of Sing, 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 when instead of going into the final ensemble, Benny pointed to Jess Stacy. Jess Stacy had never taken a piano solo in Sing, Sing, Sing. So he, off the top of his head, he improvised 2 minutes of the most beautiful music that you could imagine. It was one of the highlights of the concert.
Your mentor early on when you were coming of age and first starting to play, your mentor then was Sidney Bechet. And I want to talk with you about studying with him and getting to know him. But first I want to play an excerpt of a recent recording that you made. You've led a band called Bechet Legacy, in which you play music associated with Bechet. And from one of your first albums, in fact, the first album in a series of records with Bechet Legacy, we're going to hear what I think is your theme song with that group, Petite Fleur.
Right. This was Sidney Bechet's most famous song. I'm sure it was a worldwide hit in 1959. Ironically, not Sidney's version. It was a version by an English band called Chris Barber, and with a clarinet player featured Monty Sunshine. But at that time, Sidney was dying in a hospital in France, and his music was being played all over the world. But at least Sidney went out with a burst of glory. He wasn't one of the forgotten pioneers like a Jelly Morton.
Well, let's hear Bob Wilbur's Bechet Legacy Group, and this is Petite Fleur. I guess Bob Wilbur featured on soprano saxophone. Now Sidney Bechet was the great soprano saxophonist and clarinetist who came out of New Orleans, started recording in the 1920s, but you met him when he was living in Brooklyn, New York. This was in the 1940s, I believe, the late 1940s. What was the state of his life and his career when you started studying with him in Brooklyn, New York?
Well, he was over the really low period in his career in the 30s when he was running a tailor shop in Harlem, practically out of music. But he was kind of felt like he was going into semi-retirement and would devote himself to teaching. He felt the jazz world had sort of passed him by, and they were interested in more modern forms of jazz. And he wanted to be able to pass on to younger people his experiences in jazz, and he was delighted with me because I was very interested in his playing, and he felt very complimented about that. But he was living in comparative obscurity, and in light of what happened in the late 40s and the rest of his career, it's amazing to think that he was in such an obscure state because his last 10 years living in France were one just one triumph after another. Million selling records. He was a household name in France. He played all over Europe. It was a triumphal ending to a very checkered career.
Well, I want to speak with you more about your career and also your early studies with Sidney Bechet, but first we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. Clarinetist and saxophonist Bob Wilbur is my guest. This Saturday, he will lead a tribute to Benny Goodman in a concert that marks the 50th anniversary of Goodman's 1938 Carnegie Hall performance. And Bob Wilbur is also the author of a forthcoming autobiography titled Music Was Not Enough, and that's due out probably next month. Well, Bob, let's talk about your studies with Bechet some more. Now, when you went to study with him in Brooklyn, you were a young man from the suburbs. Did you want Bechet to introduce you to the jazz life as well as to help you with jazz music?
Yeah, I really wanted to soak up every aspect of jazz, the life, the way musicians thought. You can get so much from listening to records, but if you don't get to know the players, you don't really know the whole story. And Sidney was like a second father to me. I lived with him, and then he started taking me on his jobs, and I get a chance to play with him.
How did you end up moving in with him?
Well, I was living down the village at that time, and my funds were rather low. And he said, well, look, why, instead of having to go back and forth to Manhattan all the time, why don't you come and live here with me? You can use the sofa in the upstairs parlor. And he was living with his wife there and a big Great Dane dog. And I just moved in. And he was working on some of his compositions. I used to help him write them down and record them. So I was helping him in his projects, too.
Is there any advice that he gave you about soloing or playing melody that's always stuck with you?
Yeah, his big thing was, he said, you have to tell a story in your music. You have to lead the listener along so that he gets into what you're doing and understands what you're doing. He said, first of all, you have to respect the melody of the song you're playing and give it the best treatment you can. And then when you make variations, they must make sense to the listener. The listener must hear the relationship of your variations to the original.
Now, didn't he tell you to stick with clarinet and stop fooling around with soprano?
Well, he said the clarinet is the basic instrument. He says once you've got that down, you'll find the saxophone is easy. But the clarinet is the fundamental instrument, and that's also what I tell my students. And I'd like to mention I have a particularly brilliant student who I'm very proud of, Antti Sarpila, who is from Helsinki, Finland. Antti's 23, and he's been studying with me since he was 16. And he is over here now, currently studying with me. And I had hoped very much to present him with my band at Carnegie Hall Saturday night. Unfortunately, we've run into a problem with the U.S. immigration, who says he doesn't have the proper work permit. So that won't be possible. But I just do want to mention him because I think he is the great young clarinetist who is going to pass, who I'm passing on my legacy to.
Has he moved in with you?
Well, virtually, because he has come to study with me every year for a month, and he's gotten grants from the Finnish government, and he's known in Finland as the Finnish Bob Wilbur.
When you got a little bit more mature with your own playing, did you want to break away from Bechet and break away from your identification as his prodigy?
Yeah, it became something. You know, when you're always living in the shadow of a great man, you feel that no matter what you do, you'll always be compared with him, and the comparison will be not favorable to you. So I did want to break away. It got to the point where I was totally identified with him. In fact, the trombonist George Brunus, he used to call us Bash and Shay, and because that was the New Orleans pronunciation of Bechet's name. They used to call him Bashay. So I did want to break away, and one of the ways I did it was to actually give up the soprano saxophone for a number of years and concentrate on the clarinet, and also I played a lot of tenor in those days. I came back to the soprano when I wandered into a music store, I guess it was in the mid-60s, and saw this little curved soprano. I'd never seen one, And it intrigued me. It looked like a little alto saxophone. Of course, the more common soprano is the straight one. So I picked it up and blew a note, and I instantly realized that there was something different about it than the straight soprano. And it gave me the idea that maybe I could do something of my own on the soprano, which would not be totally identified with Bechet.
Well, that curved soprano, it looks like a little baby alto, actually. And yeah. It's become visually your trademark. Not many people play this kind of curved soprano.
Right.
Have you been able to find new ones when you need them?
No, it's very difficult. I had, through the years, I've collected three of them. One of them was stolen from a job once, but I still have the two. But they are very rare. The good ones were made in the 20s.
I want to get back to when you left Bechet. Was it hard for you to find your own identity? Because this was in the 1950s. It was a time when most of the young players who were getting recognized were playing bop of one sort or another.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of music that you never really played or wanted to play.
I appreciated what the bebop players were doing, and I heard them when they were coming up in the 40s on 52nd Street, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk. But I didn't identify with it as far as my feeling about music. It didn't touch me the way Benny and Louis Armstrong and Sidney Bechet did. And you're right, that was a period of searching for me, the 50s and the 60s, when I was trying to find my own identity and trying to find where do I belong in this crazy jazz world. I describe this in my book, and I had some pretty low times before I began to feel that I knew who I was. And the title, I think, refers to the fact that
The title being Music was not enough.
Yeah, I figured when I was young that music was going to be the answer to everything. You know, I could forget about any other problems dealing with human relationships or anything of that sort, because music was going to be the answer. And I found, particularly in this period of searching, that you had to be more than just a musician. You had to be a human being, and you had to relate to people. And this has become increasingly important to me as I grow older. And my friends and my wife, who's such a support to me, Pug Horton, they're more important to me than anything else.
Well, you know, one of the things I really value about the kind of repertory music that you frequently play is that it doesn't come with the costumes and all the little period tacky touches. You know how a lot of those bands have to, like the kind of trad bands, the musicians would have to wear the striped shirts and the visors and act like they were in some kind of play.
That's right, yeah. No, I try to avoid anything which gives the impression that the music is dated or old-fashioned. For instance, bands playing traditional jazz, many of them consider it's absolutely necessary to have a tuba and a banjo. Well, it's not necessary at all, but those instruments can be played very musically, you know. But the thing to do is to capture the essence, the spirit of the music.
Well, I want to play some more of your music, but first I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and I wish you the best in your Carnegie Hall concert coming up this Saturday.
Terry, thanks. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you. Okay. My guest has been musician Bob Wilbur. Many of his recordings on Fantastic and Jazzology are now being reissued on compact disc. He has a new autobiography titled Music Was Not Enough, and that will be published probably next month in the United States by Oxford University Press. This Saturday, he'll perform in New York City in a concert that's a tribute to Benny Goodman on the anniversary of Goodman's historic 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. This concert, too, will be held in Carnegie Hall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.